This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from the China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series. And John is threatening to leave this podcast because of my obsession about acting like a news anchor. More on this after the break. My co-host is John Paston, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and he snores so loudly that it scares everyone in the car he's driving. Anyone can learn a language, but in this episode, John and I are going to talk about the five qualities of good language learners. Guest interview is with Zachary Gidwitz, who, despite having a Chinese teacher tell him to give up, later progressed to a level that opened up job opportunities with one of China's largest e-commerce giants. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hello people, my name is John Pasden. I am in the city of Shanghai, China.
Okay, John, before we kick in today, we do have a listener question.
Right, so this one is from John WS, and he says, just out of curiosity, how do you and your team determine which Chinese names you will give your Mandarin Companion characters? Do you have them somehow on the 100 most common Chinese surnames and spread those out amongst the levels? Or does someone say, I have a cousin named He Jia, let's go with that? All right, good question.
Yeah, very good question. John, you do most of the naming, so I'm familiar with the process, but you know, hey.
Yeah, so Jared has input, but I work with a Chinese team because we want to make sure every Chinese name that we use in our book sounds like a real Chinese name. And so I always turn to native speakers for that. But we do start with this list of the 100 most common Chinese surnames, and we focus on like the top 20. And we want to make sure that we hit the surnames that people are most likely to see in China, you know, that their friends are going to have. So when you're learning these character names in the books, you're actually learning, you know, useful surnames that you're going to come across on your own. And they have to sound good. They can't be some super obscure characters because, you know, modern Chinese people can often have some very obscure characters in their given names. Yeah, so can ancient Chinese people. But anyway, we do not want to do that to our readers. We want to make sure that they're learning characters that they'll at least commonly encounter in other people's names, if not in non-name words.
The other added bonus, too, is that, you know, there's a lot of times in the names will also contain characters that are maybe commonly known or that will occur in other words. So you kind of get it like a double whammy in some of those names, right?
Yeah, and we do have to be careful, though, because we don't want certain names to be like kind of confusing. Like there are some names where if we chose them, the way that they appear with other words could frequently be confusing, and we don't want to distract from the story. So we want to avoid that, too.
Well, there you go. That's how we do it.
Oh, and one other trick that I like to do is when I'm looking at movie credits after a Chinese movie, I just keep an eye out, or any list of Chinese names, really, whether it's like names on an ad, you know, like the name of the star promoting the shampoo or whatever it is. I just look at Chinese names all the time, and I'm on the lookout for like a common surname and then, you know, a pretty easy to read given name and a combination that works well. We'll probably have to swap out the surname. We can't just use a star's name, but, you know, something like that.
Fascinating process. Well, there you go. That's how we do it. John W.S., S.W., whoever you are, thanks for sending your question. And anyone else, if you have a question, feel free to email us at feedback@mandarincompanion.com.
Yeah, we'll be happy to answer those questions. All right, so today our topic is about the five qualities, or you might say attitudes, of good language learners. There are certain traits, almost like personality traits, but I don't want to call them personality traits because these are things that can be learned. These are things that you can kind of focus on, like attitudes towards your learning that will help you do better.
And I also think it's good to note that, you know, that's not a full, exhaustive, comprehensive list, but I think, you know, John and I, we did go have some back and forth on these, but these are definitely ones we agree on that are important for anyone who's going to achieve a significant level of proficiency in any language.
And I took a poll of our Chinese teachers, and they gave us pretty much a lot of these same things over and over in slightly different wording.
All right. So what's number one, John?
Okay, so number one, the word I like to use is just curious, but it might not be curious. I might just be really interested. It might be a keen observer. It might be fascinated. But anyway, Chinese does not bore you. There's something about it, whether it's the culture, the characters, the sounds of the language, you know, the music, whatever it is, it just keeps pulling you in and makes you want more and more.
Now, the curiosity aspect, I mean, this is actually something that's repeated a number of times in a lot of educational theory as a really important quality for just learning. And if you think about it, if you're just not curious, you're probably not going to pursue any knowledge or learning about a specific subject if you don't have any interest or curiosity about it. So definitely really important.
So that's not just to say, like, get curious, like, you're not curious enough, be more curious. But I think that some people kind of don't indulge their curiosity, and that would be a mistake. So, for example, you know, you learn a new character, and you're just like, oh, I wonder what other words use this character. And it's really easy to look that up in Pleco, right? But, you know, if you're kind of fighting that, you're like, oh, I'm not ready for that. I don't want to look that up. Well, why? Like, just be curious. I see again and again, it doesn't have to be in a dictionary, all kinds of curiosity, whether it's about people's lives or whether it's about, you know, structure of society or whatever, that drives people to want to learn more, and then it really helps them gain the language faster.
And I think it'd be great to note that this aspect of curiosity and interest is a little different than like getting caught in a clickbait doom scrolling loop, you know, infinite loop there. You know, it's not just like, you know, casually just, oh, this is interesting. It's more of like curiosity and interest more with meaning and purpose, more like deliberate curiosity. It's like, it just as you were highlighting there, John, oh, I'm interested in maybe this character thing. So you're kind of looking into that. So I think that's just a little important thing that's a little more relevant, especially to our modern days.
Yeah. And I think you can see it in someone's face. It's like a spark in their eye. And behind their eyes, there's like this fire. They really want to learn. So anyway, curiosity, that's a good one. All right, number two,
sociable, also kind of like outgoing or talkative. And I even hesitant saying outgoing because, you know, John, I know you're not necessarily the most outgoing guy, but you are very sociable and you're talkative, right? These are important qualities for a language learner.
Yeah, and this is one that I also thought about quite a bit as we were compiling this list, because not everyone is talkative, not everyone is outgoing, but it does seem like people who are outgoing and just want to talk, they do have an edge because they get more practice. And if you think about like having a lesson with a teacher and there's two of you, if one person's introverted and the other one's extroverted, the extrovert is going to get so much more practice. And it's not fair, but that's the way it is. So like I remember when I was, you know, barely able to speak Chinese, and I was living in Hangzhou, hadn't been in China very long at all, and I just forced myself to be more outgoing, because I knew I needed it, and because it was just such a weird kind of surreal experience being in China when I could barely communicate, but I could kind of communicate, I almost let myself like get into this weird mentality where it wasn't really real. It was almost like a video game. And I was just like talking to people about stuff. And you know, all kinds of magic happens when you start talking to more people.
And you know, you bring up something I think is really important. It's that aspect of like when you're speaking a second language that you're learning, it feels like it's not real, like the video game as you described it. But it's almost like a different persona. And you can be a different person almost sometimes in that language. And sometimes you can leverage that if you have a bit of the anxiety or the fear or worry about, you know, maybe you don't feel as outgoing or whatever. You can kind of leverage that a little bit to sometimes be a little bit more outgoing or sociable or talkative.
And I should mention that this is why some people feel like if they start drinking that their language level improves. probably doesn't really improve, but it does help them be more outgoing, less reserved, less worried about making mistakes and more interested in talking, right?
Yeah, definitely. But in general, just, you know, being sociable, I do think it, you know, a little bit, it is going to be linked with some curiosity, but, you know, you'll just have more things to talk about. And there are some people out there which are excellent conversationalists, and of course, your native language. And if you can kind of leverage that to talk in Chinese. But sometimes I think that the opportunities to be sociable in Chinese are even more than there might be in your native language, because oftentimes you have the opportunities to speak about things that you may not understand, or talking about different items of culture that you can learn from, or your observations. Of course, you want to make sure you're not being any offensive in any of those things, but it does give more topics of conversation, and therefore you can be a little bit more sociable and talkative.
Yeah, and if you're in a kind of a smallish Chinese city, a lot of people maybe haven't really talked to a foreigner before, at least not in Chinese. And so they really want to hear what you have to say in Chinese. I remember once recently, I wasn't being outgoing. I was being, you know, kind of introverted John. And I met this guy, and he's a film director, and we were having a chat. We were talking about some Chinese movies and stuff. And he started asking me these, like, really hard questions. And I didn't even know how to answer those questions in English. And I just felt the urge to be talkative kind of fading. I was just kind of like, yeah, I don't know, man. No, I don't know. And later on, he complained to his wife, like, that guy doesn't like me. He wouldn't talk about these topics. And so you can't do it all the time. But when you can do it, it does help.
And for anyone who's not living in a small town in China, if you have some Chinese people around you or friends or a tutor or whomever, that does give you an opportunity to talk to them and sometimes ask things about their home country, things about their culture, because sometimes you're not aware of those, you know, cultural differences until you're outside of it and you're looking in. But someone who's been living outside of their country for a long time might be able to understand a little bit better. Oh, these are some of the differences I've noticed. And those can be a lot of topics for conversation and therefore you being sociable.
All right. So sociable definitely intersects a bit with curious. All right. But number three, we talk about being committed or possibly disciplined. But anyway, you're going to stick to it. You're not going to give up. I hesitate to use this word discipline because I think a lot of us just think of like, oh, you have to study for 1 hour every night, no matter what. You have to do 300 flashcard reps every day, no matter what. And I don't know, it just seems a little bit masochistic or something. But if you're going to get good at Chinese, you clearly have to put in the time. And that doesn't work if you only do it once, you know, a month or something.
Definitely. The commitment. And this is something, you know, John and I, we're having a little back and forth on this one. And, you know, there's a bit of a balance sometimes between motivation, you know, and commitment. Motivation will oftentimes get you going, but commitment keeps you on that path. I mean, there's all been times where maybe we were excited about something and we had some idea or wanted to do this or that, but maybe we didn't see it through. So that commitment is really important to say, I'm really going to learn this language. I'm going to be consistent, and I'm going to see this process through.
Yeah, and I think what really helps with being committed is just kind of knowing what to expect. So in the beginning, the tones are going to be hard. You're going to be bad at them for a while, and it's just going to take quite a bit of practice before you get a handle on them. So you got to be committed to that process in order to enjoy the results. And at the same time, once you get through there and you get all the way to like the intermediate level, you might feel like you've been plateauing for a really long time. Like, when am I going to really get to the next level? But if you can stay committed and just kind of have faith that all this work is going to add up to something more, then you will get to the next level.
And because there are going to be those hard times. You're going to have, I always talk about different stages of learning Chinese, but there are those, the trough of sorrow, you know, where you're afraid you're never going to learn anything and you've been studying for a while and you feel like, I haven't gotten anywhere. It's not improving. But we were all going to have some points like that in any language that we're learning. And so that commitment really will see you through. And you know, it's always the element of faith in there too, like hope, belief, I'm going to get through this on the other end and I'm going to actually arrive at some level of proficiency or fluency that I want to at some point.
And definitely this helps with learning any language, but I think with Chinese especially, it's necessary. Okay, so what is number four, Jared?
Number four, realistic. Oh, this one's really important for our day and age. How many times have you seen a clickbait that says, the one trick to learn a language that language teachers hate, you know, stuff like that. Okay, being realistic about learning a language is really important.
Right, so this is going to help you stay committed because you know that you're not going to master the tones in a week. You're not going to be fluent after watching three videos. You're realistic about your expectations. You're committed, you're sociable, you're curious, and that is going to get you results for sure.
That's right. You know, there are a lot of videos out there and programs. People say, yo, you're going to be fluent in 3 months. I've seen a TED Talk, a guy fluent in 6 months. There are possibilities, in those areas, but those require like full-time, 100% focus and immersion. And that's not realistic for most of us. And even coming out of that, you don't necessarily have the full depth that experience and time brings with, you know, in a language. So I think, yeah, being realistic that, hey, it may take you some time to learn tones, get your pronunciation down, just acquiring the vocabulary, and that's just the knowledge aspect, much less the proficiency of putting it all together and actually being able to speak comprehensible sentences and then understand things and, you know, automatically process the language in your head. I mean, all these things just take time.
And I think another important part of being realistic is not being a perfectionist. So, you know you're not going to master the tones in 2 days, but you also need to practice Chinese. And so you have to be able to forgive yourself for having terrible tones for a while. You know, you have to know that you're going to struggle a bit to get your meaning across because you don't have the vocabulary. But, you know, this is the best you can do. You're out there, you're talking to people, you're communicating, you're learning. And that's going to help you get to the next level for sure.
I recall one piece of advice someone had given me once, and I wouldn't say it's total gospel truth per se, but I think it's a little bit indicative. He said, try for 100% accuracy on tones because you won't get there, but you'll get like 80% and that's going to be good, right? And pointing out, John, you know, you still make mistakes on your tones, right?
Oh, yeah. Fortunately, fewer than I used to, much fewer than I used to, but yeah, not perfect, but doing fine.
Still happens. So it's realistic. Now, there are some people who just, you know, really focus on certain elements and they'll nail it, and that's fine. But just being realistic about it really helps. You know, I went in with learning Chinese at the beginning, like, I'm going to be fluent in a year. I didn't really know what that meant, and that didn't happen. But I've since talked to many people that had that idea, and that maybe wasn't as realistic, and reality will hit you pretty fast sometimes. So I think, yeah, just being realistic, that also helps you to avoid discouragement and will help you to maintain your commitment in learning the language.
All right, number 5. This one's a bit linguisticy, but bear with me here. This one is tolerant for ambiguity. So tolerance for ambiguity is something that comes up a lot in the literature for applied linguistics and second language acquisition. But it's actually pretty interesting, and I think it's worth talking about a little bit. Do you know what this is, Jared? Beyond the meaning of the words?
Yes. Yes. So I think it's being okay without being certain exactly what you're saying is totally correct or if you're 100% understanding everything that the other person is saying.
Right. So this is also a little bit related to that concept of not being a perfectionist, but it's often more related to like comprehension. So here, let me quote some stuff from a paper. Budner defined intolerance of ambiguity as the tendency to perceive ambiguous situations as sources of threat. sounds a little ridiculous, but okay. And then Norton conceived of intolerance of ambiguity as a tendency to perceive or interpret information marked by vague, incomplete, fragmented, multiple, probable, unstructured, uncertain, inconsistent, contrary, contradictory, or unclear meanings as actual or potential sources of psychological discomfort or threat. So, man, I got to say, that's like every conversation for like the first, you know, 2 years.
Yeah, that definition got me running scared right now. Holy cow.
Yeah, people are incomplete. They're vague. They're unstructured. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, but I get that. And I can't say, John, that that's something I struggle with every once in a while. Sometimes I want to be precise. You know, I want to know that what I'm saying is accurate and that the other person is understanding me in the way that I want to be understood. But, you know, we have that issue sometimes, you know, in English as well. I mean, with my own language. So you got to have some of that tolerance for ambiguity, of course, but there's definitely going to be really, that's an important aspect, I think, of that of learning Chinese.
Right. So you bring up a point of how it's related to production, you know, speaking, Maybe not being quite sure if your meaning is getting across, but still going for it anyway and striving to actually communicate. But then there's also the receptive abilities, right? Like for example, reading. So if you're reading a graded reader, you're doing your best to understand it. You don't have a translation. You don't have an opposing page full of pinyin, but you're doing your best to read it. Then that effort at trying to comprehend, even though you know you're not getting 100%, you're getting it high enough that you can continue and then you can start to make sense of it as you go. But if you stop as soon as something is incomplete or vague or uncertain, then you're just not going to make the progress.
You know, this is along the lines that I see sometimes when people might email us at Mandarin Companion asking, hey, is there an English translation of your books? And I'm like, actually, we don't do that. We don't provide an English translation because of this very exact aspect that you need to become a little more comfortable with having that 100% comprehension. And, you know, if you are having trouble with that, the meaning and of what you're trying to read and what you're trying to learn, well, go back and review. Maybe you need to talk to a tutor or something that can help you through some of those things.
Yeah, and let me tell you, Jared, some of my clients at All Set Learning, I totally see this. Like some of them, they have to like be super clear on all these details and it just slows them down so much. Like they spend so much time trying to confirm the precisely every detail that they're just not spending a whole lot of time on meaningful communication, and they don't make as good a progress as someone who's, you know, they're trying to talk about the issues, they're kind of not worrying too much if they didn't catch every last, you know, word, because they're focused on communication.
Another place I see this pop up is sometimes when people want an exact translation of something. You know, they want to know exactly how does this translate, or they have a phrase or something in that they're using in their native language when they want to directly translate that into Chinese. And sometimes there is no direct translation, so you kind of have, I would argue, an accurate translation that translates that meaning. But sometimes people aren't happy with it. No, I want it to, you know, like you're saying, a greeting, what's up? You know, you don't translate that into Chinese. You have the equivalent of that.
Yeah, I got to say, tolerance for ambiguity may not be a virtue when it comes to translation, because a lot of times translation, you're really trying to communicate an exact meaning. But when it comes to language learning, it is going to get you to the next level. It's going to make you a better learner. You're going to learn faster, and you're going to have better conversations for sure.
All right, so just to wrap this up, 5 qualities of good language learners. So number 1, curiosity. 2, being sociable, talkative. 3, being committed. 4, being realistic, having realistic expectations. And 5, tolerance for ambiguity. I think that sums it up pretty good.
Yeah, and these are kind of attitudes, right? So it's not your personality. It's stuff that you can actually work on a little bit. Try to change your attitude, tweak it a little bit, and you might get some good results.
Definitely. So if you say, hey, I'm not the most committed person, well, you can work on that. We can manage our own expectations about being realistic. I think this conversation about having tolerance for ambiguity, hopefully, open up maybe some things that you hadn't considered or see things in a little different way. And we can all be more curious and sociable. I mean, these are definitely things that we can learn and we can improve in our own lives.
Yeah, so these qualities, these attitudes will definitely help you, and you can learn Chinese.
Definitely. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion Graded Readers. We have a special, exciting new book to tell you about today.
And the new book is Sherlock Holmes and a Scandal in Shanghai.
All right, so a lot of you love our level 1 Sherlock Holmes graded reader, The Case of the Curly-Haired Company. This is a level 2 Chinese graded reader. So that's 450 characters that you need to be able to read to handle this story, and it's a great story.
It's based on the Arthur Conan Doyle story of a scandal in Bohemia, but this one's set in Shanghai. It involves the international community of the 1920s Shanghai period, and we actually bring some real historic figures into this book, which is kind of exciting.
And for you continuity buffs out there, it definitely connects with the first Sherlock Holmes story, as well as the prequel, Xiaoming. And it comes together nicely. It's a good story.
So you can go out there and get it. You can find it on Amazon. The print book is going to be available on Amazon. The ebook will be available on other platforms right now. It's not going to be available on Kindle. Unfortunately, right now, there's some technical issues. But we hope to have it up there soon. But you can go out and get it today. Sherlock Holmes and a Scandal in Shanghai. It's our level 2, 450 character, Manic Companion, graded reader.
And if you do get it and read it, please let us know what you think.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave, and it's kind of a weird rave. Because, you know, earlier this year we were in lockdown here in Shanghai. We were having trouble getting food. And you know that that German grocery store called Aldi? Do you have it in Utah?
Yeah. I grew up with it in the Midwest, but Aldi's, they're a German grocery store chain, and I know they opened there in Shanghai a few years ago, right?
Aldi's, yes. We Americans call it Aldi's. Okay, but yeah, we do have it in Shanghai. And during the lockdown, I couldn't order from it, but it's crazy how fast this store is. So I use their mini app within WeChat to order from Aldi on my phone, and it's literally at my door within 30 minutes, and it's not even that it's not even that close to my home. So it's just so weird, like seeing this German chain just become this really awesome grocery store in Shanghai.
Wow, that's impressive. 30 minutes. I mean, like that's like almost too fast. It's like, didn't you have to like pull these off the shelves or something first?
Like if I got on a motorbike and went straight to Aldi for my home, I feel like it would take at least 10 minutes. So that's really fast. Anyway,
it's pretty amazing.
I don't want to bore you with Shanghai logistics. Jared, do you have a rant or a rave?
I have a rave today. All right, and so this is something I watched recently. It's a documentary called The Six. John, I've already mentioned some of this to you, but let's just rewind to 2 months ago. At that time, did you know that there were Chinese people on the Titanic?
I did not.
Well, there were. In fact, there were 8 Chinese men on the Titanic, and 6 of them survived. And this documentary is about the 6 survivors. Well, actually, it does look into all 8 of them, but it's a focus on the 6 survivors from the Titanic. And I had no idea that there were any Chinese people on the Titanic, much less survivors. And it's a fascinating documentary that essentially follows the journey of a research team, more or less, on trying to discover and find out what happened to these 6 people who 6 Chinese people who survived the Titanic disaster. And I'm telling you, it was fascinating, and it was just it was kind of like a weave of story, you know, finding out, you know, who these guys were. And it was really interesting because you have their names on the log and all these. There were actually a lot of things that were said about the Chinese people who survived. They were kind of negative because there was a lot of negative perceptions about Chinese during that day. And they kind of heaped that on as well on the story, saying, you know, they were hit on the lifeboats or whatever. And so they investigate all these things and find out what happened to them. And anyway, I don't want to ruin it, but it was a fascinating documentary. I've actually been in touch with the director since then. And John, we might actually get him here on the podcast.
All right. Wait, Jared, let me ask you. Are you like a Titanic fan in general?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a Titanic fan. I mean, I think it's interesting. I've watched the movie, you know. Hey, it's a great movie. But I'm like not like a Titanic history buff or anything. But this definitely drew me in. I was really excited to watch this, and it was really interesting.
All right.
So it has like a very interesting distribution right now. It's available in some countries. Other countries, it's not. It's actually not available, I think, in the U.S. or the U.K. right now. But you can go online. You can check it out. It's thesixdocumentary.com. We'll put a link in the show notes, and hopefully it'll be out soon. And I think we can get the director here on our show.
All right, so stay tuned, and you'll probably hear him sooner or later.
My name is Zachary Goodwitz. I am born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, United States. I have been living in Beijing, China for the last 10 years.
Zach is modest and down to earth. The type of guy after chatting for a while, you feel like you've known him for years.
I am a director at JD.com, and I help this massive e-commerce company do a lot of internationalization, strategic partnerships, and some innovation projects as well.
Zach's story is a great example of how, with the right setting and purpose, you can learn Chinese despite any previous setbacks, and how learning Chinese can open up new career opportunities. Stay with us. Okay, Zach, why did you start learning Chinese?
So I fell into that trap I was warned about in high school where people end up doing what they do second best. Because things that they do best comes easily to them, and so they actually devalue it. My math teacher really was thinking I was going to go into math, but instead I really wanted to challenge myself and wanted to try a language. I always kind of fantasized, like, what would it be like to be able to think in another language? And that always seemed just like a far-off fantasy to me. It didn't really seem realistic. But I said, well, college is a really good chance to start. And if I'm going to choose a language, might as well choose a language that allows me to speak with the most people possible. And Chinese is definitely that. Also, economics major, ancient Chinese philosophy, all of that.
So it sounds like you were faced with that decision, what you're going to major, what you're going to study at college. And it was like, math or Chinese? Ah, let's go Chinese, right? I know math. That's fine. Whatever. I undervalue. But let's do Chinese, something I have no experience with, right?
It was kind of like that, exactly. And at first, I really was thinking it would just be one of many courses, do it over 4 years, should be able to pick it up enough to then be able to go to China and have some interesting experiences. That was really the extent of my goal. It turns out that it's really, really hard to learn Chinese. And it's really, really hard to learn Chinese in school. And I had to work on it so much that really it was like I was learning Chinese and doing a little bit of college on the side. So my teacher had this rule that if you missed more than 3 classes the whole year, you failed. That old school Beijing, real kind of hard ass. Not sure I'm allowed to say that on the podcast. Apologies. I missed 26 classes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she was just assuming I was going to give up. She was assuming that that was it for me. Now, I had sort of an excuse. I had mono, and I really should have been on medical leave and had to do a big negotiation with her. I had to redo all the homeworks, retake all the tests, and then I had to do a summer school. And only if I got A's in all of that could I pass, and I did. And she gave me a B-. And I said, what's with that? Why a B-? And she said, well, you should have failed. What are you complaining about? That really showed me that if I wanted to do this seriously, it was just going to have to take over my whole life, and I was not ready to do that. At the same time, the other thing that motivated me to, I'll say, not give up on Chinese is fear of regret. You know, see myself in the future in my 40s or 50s and thinking, oh man, I always say, oh, one day I'll learn Chinese, one day I'll learn Chinese, but it never really happens. And everyone always was saying the earlier the better. And I was just terrified of looking back with regret. So instead of continuing to study at school, I actually dropped it. But then I started my first company my sophomore year of college to develop software to help other people study Chinese, right? It got me to a place where Chinese continued to just be part of my life, kept it there, kept it present so that I could tell myself I haven't given up yet.
I'm all curious about a few details here of your story. So math or Chinese, but anything else options like chemistry, business, life sciences? I'm curious, you know, you kind of had like that binary choice, but really there was a multiplicity of choices. And also you didn't give up. Right. And what was that drive that you're still pulling you towards Chinese?
So I always fancied myself as someone who was interested in the world and how the world works. So I ended up majoring in economics of all things.
So did I. Hey.
Hey, there we go. And, you know, if you really want to know how the world works, and of course, that's very reinforcing for Chinese, right? The greatest economic story of human history. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't some sort of prodigy at math. There were kids in my class who, there was one kid I remember specifically, he was so bored in our calculus class that he ended up writing the entire test out in binary. and he got the top grade in the class. So it's like, I wasn't like that. But whether it was economics or psychology, all these things that really have to do with understanding how people work, that was really what has always interested me. And the more people I could get to know and understand different cultures, that really kept me in the international economic development path. And so they didn't have a specific major in that where I went to school, which was Wesleyan University, a small liberal arts college. But they did have very strong economic development focused courses. And after college, I kept in touch with one of the professors who ended up going to the UN after I decided, okay, this Chinese study software, there's a better one out there called Pleco. The founder of that is
Mike Love.
Well, Mike Love, exactly. Yeah. One of the nicest people in the world. And so when I'm trying to like motivate my team, no, we got to be number one and beat them. I didn't want to beat him. I wanted to give him a hug. And frankly, we were just not as good. Ended up spinning that down. I was lucky enough to get a job at the UN and worked there for a little over a year in the headquarters in New York. But I was that one dumb American who could only speak one language. There was only one thing worse than that, which was people knowing I studied Chinese and coming to me and were like, hey, you learned some Chinese, right? Can you help me read this? I was like, mm-hmm. No, I really can't. Yeah. So it was like that imposter syndrome. And speaking of imposter syndrome, the idea of being this guy who says he's really interested in internationalization, economic development, and had never lived anywhere other than the East Coast of the United States, that just didn't sit right with me. And so ended up applying to a Fulbright grant, got that, and ended up moving to China with the initial idea that I was just going to study for 6 months, learn the language, done, head back home. Didn't work like that. Couldn't learn the language in 6 months.
What? What?
I know. Can you believe it? They extended it to a year, and even that was just good enough to get me an internship.
Well, I think that's fascinating. And you know something that I think is even encouraging? At least saying that Chinese didn't come naturally to you. You said that at the beginning, like, hey, it was really, really hard. I'm going to put a caveat on that for you. It didn't come easy. You went to China, 6 months, wasn't enough, a year, still feel like I'm barely able to, you know, I guess, what, converse, read something, right? And so it doesn't come easy for everyone. I feel like it didn't come easy for me. Still doesn't sometimes, you know. And that gives a little bit of hope, I think, for everybody else, right? So let's talk about that. What were you doing to learn the language at this point?
I want to stay on that point for a second in terms of when you say it didn't come easy for me, because it really didn't. I've even met people later on, you know, they're polyglots, and they were able to really just pick it up and get to a place where they were speaking what to me it seemed at the time like fluent Chinese. And I was just like, this is never going to happen. And in fact, my Chinese teacher, who should be a fairly good judge of character or this student versus that student's real chance of getting to a level where they're going to get it, she told me to give up.
Oh, wow. One of those teachers. Great.
Yeah. And she didn't do it in like a mean way. And this wasn't even when I was missing all the classes. I kept coming back to her throughout my undergrad, be like, I haven't given up yet. What would you suggest? How should I get back into it? How should I keep doing it? And she just sat me down and said, Zachary, how about when you go to China, you get an interpreter? I don't think you should keep doing this, right? And so she told me that I wasn't going to be one of the ones who got it. There was a little bit where that was like, you know, motivating, no, I'm going to prove her wrong, all that. But I don't want to overly romanticize that. It was demoralizing. That said, I like to interpret what she said as true. And I mean this in a little bit of a weird way, where if I were someone who would be influenced by that statement, then she's right. Then I would not have ever learned Chinese. If I wasn't so committed where I would just blow past that, that I wasn't just going to pick it up. I wasn't going to study a couple hours on the side. But it wasn't until I went to China and did immersion courses where it really started to give me a path to that click happening. Even then, it didn't even happen in my first year. I wasn't even good enough to do an immersion course when I got to China. I did some other sort of private school where people pay too much money to be in not a good enough class. You know, students in the class weren't serious enough. And so I felt it was holding me back. So I then switched to private tutoring for 4 hours a day, which is a brain-melting experience. just one-on-one, right? You have no defense against the teacher.
No buffers.
No buffers. And did that for a few months. That got me to the level where I could do the immersion course. I did something called ACC, Associated Colleges in China. It's out of Minzu Daxue, which is it's a very good program, and they're very strict. They're the ones who say, if we hear that you drunkenly 3 a.m. Saturday night spoke English, first time is a strict warning, second time your A goes to a B, and third time you're out of here. And by the end of that, I asked some people, I was like, cool, I've been doing this for a long time now. Do you think my Chinese is good enough to get an internship? And they were all like, no. even then, it wasn't good enough. And so then I did IUP.
And tell everyone, IUP is?
I think it's called Inter-University Program. That's what it stands for. It used to be the premier program actually out of Taiwan, and then they moved it to the mainland. And you'll find a lot of academics there, actually, people who are studying Chinese very seriously because they're pursuing a career in academics. And that's where I got to the level where I could read news articles in Chinese and listen to the radio. Some they had courses on that. They had courses on ancient Chinese. And only after that was I able to get to the point where I could get that internship. And it was only during that internship where I was in a Chinese office being forced to try and speak Chinese all day. And my job was literally reading Chinese news and translating it into English summaries. That's when that click happened.
Wow. So, I mean, it sounds like you had some really intensive experiences there. And if I'm piecing together that timeline, by the time you studied hardcore with a tutor and went through this intensive course and then another intensive course and then off to an internship, that was that, what, a year and a half?
Exactly. That was a year and a half. And that got me to a place where I was starting to be seen as someone, oh, you can actually speak Chinese. By the way, that wasn't even all I was doing. So I still had Plico. Anytime I heard a new phrase or a new word, especially a new Chengyu, I would put it in Plico. I would try and study, and I would listen to certain podcasts, including one by your co-host.
John Pasden. Hey, hey.
Oh, yeah. Big ups there. So I grew up in China, quote unquote, listening to John and Jenny. The more I could expose myself to different things, you know, they would teach a certain type of Chinese or a certain type of phrases, certain types of topics. That really, you know, you put all those different data pieces together and eventually the lines start connecting one dot to another and things start to click more and more. When I was doing an interview for my job and I was actually able to follow along. We were talking about clean energy technology and I realized that, oh my gosh, I'm participating in a conversation about solar panels in Chinese. Like, this is very cool. And I want to make it clear though, this is not bragging. It's actually way easier than you think, because all of these different specialties, they only have a handful of really specialized words, and then you just plug those words into sort of a core set of vocabulary that you already have, and you're good to go. I would say that's number one. Number two would be once I started texting a lot in Chinese, I was able to start making friends, and the conversations or the whole relationship was in Chinese rather than in English. That really was a major signpost along my journey to fluency of being like, yes, you are progressing on this path. You have reached a new milestone. You have Chinese relationships. And again, that was right in that 1.5 year to 2.5 year mark after being in China. So yeah, I still would say I don't have a natural gift for language. I live my life in Chinese now. I'm presenting to top executives who don't speak any English. A lot of my relationships, family, all of it's done in Chinese. But I think it really has to do with persistence and continuing to get better and better and be humble about it. And also beg people to keep correcting you. I'll say that.
Yes.
Don't let people be like, good enough, sure, it's fine. Be like, no, I know it's not good enough. I know I sound ridiculous. Please help.
I don't want you just to be able to understand me. I want to be able to say it right.
Yeah.
Good being the enemy of great. A lot of times people may not be aware, hey, you know, what can I do with Chinese per se, like as far as career and jobs? Maybe you could talk about some of the career opportunities that opened up to you because you were able to speak Chinese at a high level of proficiency.
So depending on your level of Chinese, different career options are definitely going to be available. So I remember I interviewed twice for that internship, actually. And the first guy who was interviewing me, he rejected me because my Chinese wasn't good enough. He needed really a native Chinese speaker. He needed someone who could call someone and make them believe that I was Chinese. Later on, when I would have conversations with people on the phone, and then I would meet them in person, and they would do a double take and be like, oh, you're a foreigner. That, I have to say, is one of the most rewarding, awesome feelings in the world for someone who's been trying to level up their Chinese for so long. You know, it gets to different levels. When you are starting out, if you get to the place where you can not just speak, but read a lot of the news translation type of things, making summaries, I would say that that actually is a lower bar than you'd think in terms of requirement, because there's not exactly a huge time pressure. It's not like you have to translate in real time. You can use Google to help out to basically figure out, okay, I generally understand what this means in Chinese, and I'm a native English, French, Spanish speaker, so I can now translate this. You got to be careful. At one point, one of our startups was in the agricultural space, and we were doing news summaries. And I remember taking a Chinese headline and putting into Google Translate, and it came out as Chinese government subsidizes rape.
Wow.
And okay. I was pretty sure that would not have passed any censors or anyone with eyeballs. So I had to do a little bit of research seeing what's going on here. Oh, it's not rape, it's rapeseed.
Yeah, I'm going to
guess. Exactly. It was rapeseed oil. I think there still is a premium to have native speakers of other languages, particularly English, who can also converse in Chinese. If you can really understand business level conversations and someone can speak to you in Chinese about business topics, then that is a huge breath of fresh air. Because I'm telling you, even very professional managers or executives in China, even if their English really is good, they would much rather speak in Chinese. They really would. They're just going to want to work with you much more. For me, especially once I got to a pretty high level of Chinese, I started a JD as an international management trainee. So they are China's largest retailer. They're pretty much like Amazon of China. And I'm very intentional in saying the Amazon of China because the business model is very different from e-commerce companies that maybe you have heard of, Alibaba, Taobao, because JD has its own logistics, does a lot of first-party sales, but it's huge in China and it's growing internationally. It's known for quality. It's known for really fast and good-priced goods and delivery because it has its own warehouse and logistics network, 1,300 warehouses, hundreds of thousands of delivery and logistics personnel. So when I joined JD, I joined in this rotational program, and I was able to try out lots of different departments. And so when I was doing my rotation, I was trying to figure out, okay, well, I haven't actually done e-commerce before. I haven't done logistics before, but I'm fascinated by all of this. How am I going to learn all of this? And the fact that I spoke both languages, Chinese and English, ended up being very valuable for certain departments, especially international logistics, which was just being formed. And I got to work right under our president of international logistics. He liked me. He thought I had a good head on my shoulders, even though I didn't know much about logistics. And he needed help in managing some of these partnerships that we were starting to build. And so actually, in the early days, really all I was a glorified translator. We had big contingencies coming from Google, Walmart, Volvo, and we would go to our automated warehouses with all this really sexy equipment, machinery, and they would say, all right, Zachary, give the tour. Now, I didn't know how to give the tour, but they were like, good luck. And so they had all of the warehouse experts, and they had all these really high-level executives who were very patient with me, and me stuck in the middle. All I had was my ability to translate. But because I was not being labeled just a translator, I was blah, 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 you know, strategic partnerships, management training, whatever. They actually were giving me the time of day, and they would ask me questions, not sort of ask through me. And so the experts were there, and I kept basically doing two-way translation back and forth, translating the Chinese to English, the English to Chinese. They would say some new concept or new phrase, and I'd be like, wait, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And then I would be learning as I went. And the executives would actually develop a very good relationship with me because it was easier for them to relate to me often than it was to a lot of the other people at JD, maybe who they couldn't speak very comfortably with. And so I then use that opportunity to develop trust, develop those relationships, have side conversations with them, get new insights, funnel those insights and ideas back to our executives. And very quickly, they were bringing me in to not just these meetings with the executives, but follow-up internal meetings. And that would be like, actually, I think they meant that. Actually, I think that might not really work well for them because of this thing that I discussed with them, or this thing about their culture, this thing, that sort of idea. So it's not just a language translator, it's a culture translator, a way of thinking translator. It's an example of where direct translation of English to Chinese or Chinese to English doesn't really do it, where there's a lot of hidden meanings or subtleties. We've developed a very strong partnership with Shopify, which is a massive Canadian tech company, and their whole business model, a lot of their culture, a lot of things are very different from Chinese companies in general and JD specifically. We had discussed many different ways of working together, and some of them were very heavy, capital intensive, others were a bit lighter, and we were pushing one way of working together that seemed like it was going to work. The executives of both companies really, really liked it, were on board, but it was so new to Shopify that when they started spreading it a little further throughout all their leadership and discussing it, they came back and asked, maybe we can do a different way. And everyone at JD was convinced that they were backing out, that this was their indirect way of saying, no, we're not actually interested, or we're not going to invest as much, things like that. So this was not really like, oh, well, Canadians are like, or Westerners are like. It was actually further than that. But it was through many, many conversations with our partners that I was able to really understand where the fear was coming from or where the concerns were coming from. And then it was many, many conversations with many different leaders and executives at JD to understand, why are you reacting this way? What is it about what they're saying that makes you assume X, Y, Z? Oh, it's because of this experience you had. Oh, it's because of that. Oh, it's because you understood this phrase to mean this other phrase or things like that. And we ended up having a very deep and well-invested strategic partnership in the end that would not have happened had it not been for that. Going back to an earlier example, so back when I was in logistics, I remember we were trying to make headway in the United States and trying to find some good logistics partners. And the way that the negotiation was being done was a very Chinese way of doing those negotiations. Everyone knows that in Chinese culture, guanxi, right, relationships are very, very important. But the Chinese way of doing negotiations can be a little bit harsher sometimes, particularly in logistics, particularly this type of negotiation. And I think that there was a lack of understanding that our U.S. partners were very interested in developing deep relationships with us, both on a corporate level and even on a one-to-one personal level. And I ended up taking over those negotiations and developing really close personal relationships with the team. We would talk all the time, talk about family, talk about everything. But so much was about sharing about, this is how JD works. This is JD logistics strategy. Here are all the different aspects of JD. And they're like, interesting. I didn't know you had that. Well, now that you say that, we can bring this on as well. And we can bring that on as well. Let's expand the pie, right? To include all these different areas. And we ended up negotiating very, very strong deal that launched a lot of our international business. And if it hadn't been not just for the language capabilities, but for that sort of cross-cultural sensitivity that I was lucky enough to be able to bring, I think that deal likely would not have materialized either.
Wow, that's really neat. Those are some great stories. You know, and Zach, this is something that is really important when people are thinking about, you know, learning the language and thinking, hey, what kind of career opportunities are there? And it's hard to like go out and find a job saying, I'm going to fill this role, right? Sometimes you get into that role through other paths, but these are things that machine translation can't do. You know, I've even heard people talking about, oh, you know, these devices you could just have, you know, the right. person speaking Chinese into this and it translates it into English in your ear and, you know, you
exactly.
converse back and forth like that. But that can never compensate for the type of role that you've been playing in these specific situations.
Couldn't agree more. I've seen, you know, a lot of those videos with those devices. I'm not even sure if all of them are real.
Yeah, some of them are a little vaporware-ish. You know, it's the actual machine translation is quite amazing. It really is. I mean, you can just translate documents and things like that, and it's going to give you a pretty good idea of what is being said, but it's going to be very difficult to capture and translate the nuance and the cultural understanding of how things are done. They're more than just the language, right?
Especially in China, it's not just about the language. It is about the cultural understanding, cultural sensitivity. One of the things that has allowed me to go as deep into some of these companies or communities and be more accepted than maybe I've seen some of my friends be is keeping the humility and the curiosity alive. Not going in there and being like, let me tell you how it works, right? No, we're doing international, so you have to do it this way. No, no, no. It's two-sided, right?
Yeah.
You need to understand what's going on in China, what this team is dealing with, what their background is, what their values are, and be able to communicate that effectively to the partners as well. And at the same time, if you continue to show curiosity into every aspect of the culture and society and all of that, first of all, I think you'll be more accepted, but you'll also be more effective as well.
If you could go back and you could do any part of your Chinese learning experience differently, what would you do differently and why?
You know, this was a very emotional experience learning Chinese. And the reason is that first, let's say you look in a dictionary and you look up the pronunciation for sure, S-H-I. And let's say you don't even put a tone on that. And you're going to find 50, 80, I don't know, maybe 100 different characters. And so you just think, oh my gosh, I'm never going to learn it. Then you keep going, you realize, oh my gosh, I can start speaking a little bit. And then as soon as people realize, oh, you can actually speak a bit, everyone realizes you've, you know, gone up a level, and they go up a level. And you're like, yeah, I don't yeah. understand anymore. Never mind. I don't got this. I got this. Yeah. I got this. I don't got this. So then you get depressed and then get up and up. And then they're like, oh, you're better again. And then you're down again. You know, I really thought I was hot stuff. And then I started doing the rotational program at JD. And I just had to listen to hours of lectures of very technical stuff every day. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm never oh, wow. getting this ever. And now it's fine. Now that's yeah. my life. So, you know, there is that whole advice of just don't give up, right? And what I would have done differently is maybe not be so depressed, because I would have known mm-hmm. that was a natural course. I guess the one thing I still am feeling a little bit of regret about is I got to a certain level of reading where I could read business news articles, I could read our weekly reports or company emails without much of a problem. I'm writing my weekly reports all in Chinese. So that's my written and reading level. But when I open a novel, and I'm not even talking about like some ancient novel, just like contemporary novel, it's really hard. Most of the words, most of the characters, I know them. But then characters I might know, but the words they make maybe I don't know, or the usage, or they're referencing things that I don't really get. And I feel like I really plateaued, to be honest, because I didn't keep investing in my reading. You know, you were telling me about Mandarin Companion the other day, and I was like, where were you when I was learning? And you were probably there, and I just didn't know about it. So that was my bad. But I really would have done that. And I remember also at IUP, they offer courses in ancient Chinese. And I really wish I had taken that, because it's not about being a scholar. There's so much of so-called ancient Chinese that is directly incorporated and it sort of lubricates modern novels. And I open a book and I'm like, huh? You know, I'll ask someone, they'll be like, oh, well, that just means X, Y, Z. And I was like, oh, I think I remember that when I took a cursory glance at the ancient Chinese, you know, textbook. So luckily, I don't think it's too late for me. I hope it's not too late. So I would like to force myself to continue to do that, because that's definitely what is stopping my Chinese from getting to the next level. But being able to keep pushing myself there earlier and taking that ancient Chinese class, that's what I would have done differently for sure.
Well, what advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
So first of all, just don't stop. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it, do it more, and add new things, right? Whether it's one textbook or one podcast or whatever is just putting more Chinese into your head, just keep doing that, because you're going to learn something like, you know, the word for monosodium glutamate or whatever, MSG, waiting, and be like, why would I ever need that? And then, oh, wait, I need
somewhere,
that.
Right?
You know, exactly. You hear it's like, oh, mm-hmm. That's actually very useful. There's so many examples of that where just random bits of knowledge end up being very useful or connect to other random bits. And then all of a sudden you've just gone up a level because you can connect all these different things. But the specific piece of advice I'll give are two, and these are both pieces of advice I got very early on. One is win the language battle. It's not comfortable, and honestly, it's not even polite. There are still people, for example, now in Chinese who they demand to only speak in English with me. I'm like, this is going to be a lot easier if we just do this in Chinese. And they're like, no, I need to get my English to improve. And I was like, yeah, I hear you, man. I mean, that's exactly what I did when I was starting out. No matter how much a Chinese person keeps speaking English to you, respond in Chinese and force yourself to keep talking. Just don't stop. Because if you keep speaking in Chinese, eventually they're going to switch over and you're not going to take the easy way out. So that is huge. I think all the immersion courses teach that. And the difference between people who are now going around China with jobs that use Chinese and relationships in Chinese and all of that, almost to a T, I see them like, oh, I remember you. You would never back down in a language battle. And everyone hated you for it, but it worked. So just deal with it. Number two, my Chinese philosophy professor, Stephen Engel, taught me this one. This is going to be even more obnoxious. Overpronounce everything with your tones. Make it so grating to a native Chinese speaker when you mess up the tones that they have no choice but to correct you. And that will give you all the feedback you need to make sure that you are using the right tones. I've seen a lot of Westerners who learn Chinese but don't really emphasize the tones. And it can be a bit painful, and it really limits their ability to have a lot of relationships in sort of just an easy and fluid way, or give cogent presentations at work or things like that. It really matters. So this is a way to get usually very polite Chinese people who think it would be, you know, a loss of face for them to correct you, to have no option but to correct you because they just can't stand it.
That's good advice, you know. It's like, if you're going to go big, right? Don't just give me a, like,
exactly.
A Lou, right?
Man, go exactly.
Commit.
Oh my gosh, I have mumbled through things so much, like, please don't correct me. And then I remember Stephen Engel, Professor Engel's advice. It's not about your face now, it's about your face later.
Wow, that's great, Zach. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to share this experience and your story with us. I think it's been really fascinating because I like hearing about how Chinese really opened up opportunities for you. And it's also an illustration that that can happen for other people as well.
Yes. If someone like me who almost gave up a bunch of times and whose Chinese teacher literally told him to give up can get to this level, then I would say the vast majority of the population can get to this level or
basically,
better.
You can learn Chinese.
Amen.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, actor, dancer, musician, model, writer, dreamer, dealer, baker, and that one gal named Deanne. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at MannerCompanion.com or tag us on social media, hashtag MannerCompanion. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo. I'd like to thank our special guest, Zachary Gidwitz, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pazden. See you next time.